TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Debt, the First 5,000 Years. David Graeber in conversation with Charlie Rose. The name of the anthropologist David Graeber came again into huge prominence at the end of 2021, when the book he co-authored with archaeologist David Wengrow was published. The dawn of everything, a new history of humanity, is described as a, quote, dramatically new understanding of human history, challenging our most fundamental assumptions about social evolution from the development of agriculture and cities to the origins of the state, democracy, and inequality, and revealing new possibilities for human emancipation, end quote. Sadly, David Graeber is not present to enjoy the acclaim or to participate in debates about the many provocative ideas laid out in Dawn of Everything. He died only weeks after finishing the book on September 2, 2020. He was 59 years young. A professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics, Graeber taught anarchism and anti-capitalist movements. He was a hugely influential anthropologist, political activist, and public intellectual, said Professor Laura Baer, head of the anthropology department at the London School of Economics. Our community of staff and students will not be the same now he is gone, but we know his brilliant work will be read by generations to come. End quote. Born in New York, David Graeber was inspired by the activism of his working-class parents. His father was a printer in the days of offset presses and fought with the international brigades against General Francisco Franco's forces in the 1936-39 Spanish Civil War. His mother was a garment worker and homemaker. She played the female lead in the 1930s musical Pins and Needles, which celebrated the American labor movement. David Graeber was assistant professor at Yale University from 1998 to 2005. The university controversially decided not to renew his contract before he was eligible for tenure. Graeber moved into what he called academic exile in the UK, first to the University of London and finally the London School of Economics. David Graeber's 2011 book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years, was an anti-capitalist analysis that struck a chord with many readers in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Another response to the 2008 crisis was Graeber's own participation in the Occupy Wall Street movement that began in Zuccotti Park in New York City's Wall Street Financial District in September 2011, the same year Graeber's book Debt, The First 5,000 Years, was published. It gave rise to the wider Occupy movement in the United States and other countries. In late December 2021, a long-lost interview showed up on YouTube that had been conducted by television journalist and talk show host Charlie Rose. There's no exact date associated with this 23-minute clip, but the topic is Graeber's book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. Charlie Rose is asking Graeber about debt, Occupy Wall Street, democracy, and capitalism.
David Graeber is here. He is a longtime political activist. Bloomberg Businessweek has called him the anti-leader of Occupy Wall Street. On top of that, he is an anthropologist. Graeber is known for asking big questions about what exactly money is and how it affects our society. I am pleased to have him back at this table as part of an ongoing conversation about government and capitalism and economic systems. So welcome. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Tell me how we ought to understand, in your judgment, debt. Your book is titled Debt, the First 5,000 Years.
It is. I first got the idea of writing the book because I was puzzled by the strange moral power debt has. The fact that it can be used to justify things that you would think couldn't be justified in any other way. It all starts, actually, when I'm having a conversation with a liberal lawyer in London about IMF austerity packages and campaigns against them, which I was involved in the global justice movement, and talking about deaths of babies in Africa, you know, when people have to cut medical services and the results are catastrophic. And she asked, well, yes, but what did you propose to do about it? And I said, well, we thought they should cancel the debts. And she was shocked. She was, but, you know, they borrowed the money. I mean, surely you have to pay your debts. Mm. And that line, it just seemed so simple and powerful. I mean, and I thought to myself, well, under what other circumstance would a very nice person like this actually support something that would lead to the deaths of thousands of babies? What is it about debt that it just seems like morality is a matter of paying your debts, that it's the very essence of morality, despite the fact that the results are often things that you couldn't morally justify in any other possible way? And I realize that this problem has been around for a very long time. It's one reason why the book has a 5,000-year scope. This kind of argument has been going on apparently since we have written records. You have people on the one hand saying morality is just a matter of paying your debts, and on the other hand saying, on the other hand, people who lend money are basically evil. And both those threads seem to run throughout world history. So I started thinking about what debt is, and I finally came to the conclusion that debt is really best conceived as a perversion of a promise. The moral power comes from the fact that it is a promise, and promises are always considered sacred. In a way, our society is built on a series of promises we make to one another. But at the same time, it's a very peculiar type of promise, because it's a promise that has been made impersonal by a kind of a combination, perverted, you might even say, by a combination of math and violence. And generally speaking, when mathematics and violence come together, bad things tend to ensue. But in this case, the effect is to make a promise transferable to others. In a way, that's what money is. It's a transferable promise. Money is just debt.
When you look at Europe today, mm-hmm. there are certain countries that look down on other countries because they believe they have, in their economic life, been frugal, mm-hmm. And others have, in their economic life, been profligate, and now they're being asked to bail out the other. And so there's some political fallout from that.
Right. It's another perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's a moral language. It has nothing to do with economics. It's not like Greek people work less than Germans. As a matter of fact, someone did a study and discovered that Greek workers actually work more hours than German ones. It's not like Greek people are getting better social services than Germans are. They're getting less good social services. So it's not like they've been having a party and not paid for it. The real origins of the Greek crisis go back to military and security spending. They have the highest military and security spending in Europe. But somehow this is the collective responsibility of the entire Greek people. And in German media, they actually use phrases like debt sinners. It's totally moralized.
And in fact, you suggest that in certain languages, the word for guilt and the word for debt is the same.
It's a really fascinating thing. When I started reading religious texts, you find this over and over again. You find it in the Vedic literature and the Brahmanas. The word for debt and sin and guilt in Sanskrit is the same word. In Aramaic, actually, the famous forgive us our trespasses, in the original Aramaic, it's forgive us our debts, just as we forgive those who owe us money. Of course, the implicit message is, well, you don't actually forgive those who owe you money, do you? So, in effect, we're all sinners. But here's the weird thing. You always see them start by saying, yes, debt, sin, guilt, they're the same thing. Morality is just paying your debts. Your life is a debt you owe to the gods, so forth and so on. But then they back off. And if you read it very closely, they're actually saying, except not really. Actually, and the Hindu scriptures, for example, you can only really repay the debt by realizing the debt doesn't exist, by becoming the thing. You repay your parents by becoming a parent, for example. In the Bible, it's not paying your debts that's sacred, it's forgiving debts, it's canceling debts, jubilee. So the question is, why do they have to start with that if they don't really believe it?
You also suggest that China, because it holds so much American debt, it's the first stages of a very, very long process in some minds to reduce the United States to a client.
Well, this is something that China has done throughout world history. So it would be hard to imagine that some people there aren't thinking along those lines. That's the way they dealt with the northern barbarians, as they always called them. Scary militaristic foreigners, which is undoubtedly how they see us. You shower them with gifts, you get them dependent. They had this tribute trade where they always gave more to their vassals than they got back. But the idea was, on the one hand, to spoil them, to make them complacent and dependent, and gradually then move in and absorb them, or can turn their military prowess to your advantage rather than against you.
And you have said that the intellectual consensus has been that we no longer in this society ask big questions. What big questions should we ask?
Well, I thought about that after 2008. There was a moment where people were questioning everything. The Economist ran a headline saying capitalism wasn't a good idea. Everybody started asking, well, what is a financial system actually for? What's an economy actually for? What is debt? Why do we have to pay?
Because they've seen it either collapsing or near collapse.
Exactly. And all the stories we had been told, that markets run themselves, that the people running them are these incredible geniuses, or the only people who are competent to run an economy, turned out not to be the case. So there seemed to be a moment where people were willing to start asking questions, and it was almost as if a panic set in. After two or three weeks, it was just like, no, just keep calm and carry on, nothing to see here, just move along. And we've just been trying to pretend nothing happened ever since, which of course is going to be disastrous, because something like that is going to happen again. They didn't resolve any of the underlying issues. They just put a big Band-Aid up.
What was the underlying issue? Was it debt?
Well, they certainly haven't resolved the debt crisis. There's a series of underlying issues. I mean, that's why you ask the big questions, is to figure out what the underlying issues are. Yes.
Yeah.
But certainly debt as a problem has not been resolved at all. We've been skating from one debt crisis to another since the 70s, really. For the first 20, 30 years, it was largely confined to the global south, so we didn't pay a lot of attention. Now it's kind of come back on us, partly because the global south successfully resisted. The IMF was kicked out of East Asia. They were kicked out of Latin America. For a while, it looked like organizations like that weren't even going to survive. And now, of course, they found a new home in Southern Europe.
Talk about Wall Street movement. And mentioned your prominence in that. Tell me how you saw your role.
I saw it mainly as a generational bridge. I'd been involved in the global justice movement. And the funny thing about activist generations, people burn out very quickly. It's very intense. So after three or four years, you show up, it's all new faces. I'd been away largely in London. I came back to New York, I had a year of leave. And it was all new people. And you know how it is. For a lot of people in the global justice movement, at least, we were sort of banging our heads against the wall for years and gradually giving up. And it's like, this year, it's going to really be back, you know? It's going to happen. This dream we had of direct democracy sort of becoming contagious and sweeping the nation, changing our very idea of what politics were. We all had an idea that it could happen, and we just kept getting our hopes up and having them dashed. And I had a sense this time that it was real. So I think a lot of what I did was just call up my friends and say, no, it's really going to happen this time. Take my word for it. Come up, come back from the farm in upstate New York or wherever you are now, and do some trainings, do medical trainings, legal trainings, affinity groups, you know, teach people our old tricks, because there's a bunch of young people who are really motivated and something's really going to happen.
And is it?
Well, I mean, we never expected anything like what happened. I mean, 500 occupations or something like that in a matter of months. Things happening all over the globe. Obviously, something that explosive, it's not going to continue like that at that pace for years on end. I mean, every movement has its ups and downs, and it was so meteoric at the beginning that, you know, obviously there's going to be a certain settling down, and we settle in for the long haul, because, I mean, social movements don't actually achieve things in a year. They need a decade, usually, to really change the face of society.
Are there any similarities between Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party?
No, I think that the Tea Party represent one aspect of the general disillusionment that Americans have with the political system. I think that one thing that...
And so they share that.
Yeah, we share a sense that politicians are basically corrupt, that what we call a democracy is either dysfunctional or not a democracy at all. I don't think it's a democracy at all.
What would you call it?
Kleptocracy? I could think of a lot of phrases, some of them more impolite. Fraud. I mean, I think that what we have is not a democratic system. It's a system of legalized bribery. In most countries, if you give politicians money to influence their vote, that's called bribery. It's corruption. It's illegal. We've managed to eliminate the corruption problem largely by legalizing it. It's not illegal.
But this is not the only place where they're not people from the private sector don't give to political parties or give to the electoral process.
It's true. Corruption exists in many places. But, I mean, it's systematic. And most places, it's not nearly so uncontrolled. People are still put in jail. For example, in Italy, one of the platforms of a populist party, the Five Star Movement, is that any politician who's gone over a certain level of the criminal process for corruption charges should not be allowed to hold office, and that's about a third of politicians.
Yeah, but politicians go to jail here for accepting... No, they do.
Oh, you know, yes. That. I mean, of course, they have to leave some things illegal.
Yeah.
But the basic idea...
Lobbyists go to jail, too.
It's true. There's limits to every system, and that's how you can say we're not corrupt. You have a few things that are just so out of line that, you know, you can arrest people for it. But the fact is, I mean, it's money that drives the system. Most people don't vote, and most people don't vote because their votes don't matter. My vote has never mattered. I'm from New York, so my vote has never mattered.
Because New York, in the end, like Texas, doesn't matter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So when you
it
have
is swing states that matter.
So how are you going to call it a democracy if most of the electorate actually has no influence on the election?
So what should you do? Change the electoral system and then you fix it?
I myself take a long-term view. I'm an anarchist. I believe that I'd like to see a genuinely free society. And what I see as a genuinely free society is one without systematic bureaucracies of violence. So I'm against states. I'm not here to tell people what to do, but I do, as a sociologist, say, well, this is not a democratic system in any sense.
But you are an anarchist in the world of ideas or more?
Oh, more. I mean, one thing that we felt very important in Occupy was creating institutions that could exist in a free society. And that's critical. We don't want to enter into the political process, not just because it's inherently corrupt, and unless you have $1 billion, you're not on a level playing field, because if you engage with that system, you've become part of it. And as a result, that space that where you can try to imagine what real democracy would be like almost completely evaporates. People start acting like politicians. They say one thing to please their funding base, another thing in private. They calculate how they can influence important political actors. Everything gets organized around personalities. It loses everything that really made this thing vital and important to us, which was the chance to experience what genuine democratic decision-making could be like.
When do you look back at our own history and say we, quote, lost it?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's not as if we started as a democracy. I mean, I always like to point out...
less than a democracy because women and African-Americans couldn't vote.
Well, yes, indeed. And as a matter of fact, when we started... I always point this out, that there nowhere in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence does it say anything about America being a democracy. Those guys were explicitly against democracy, and they said so. John Adams was, like, quite... up front, he said, we can't have a majority vote. There's 9 million people with no property, maybe 1 or 2 million people with property. If we allowed majority vote, the first thing they'd do is they'd abolish the debts, and then they'd, you know, redistribute the land. So he said this. So they were anti-democratic. They set up the system, which was sort of, their ideal was Republican Rome rather than Democratic Athens. That's,
let me come back to a couple of points.
They renamed it a democracy in the 1830s, and ever since we're supposed to call it that, but that's never what it was supposed to be.
What's the relation between democracy and capitalism?
It's an interesting question. Again, it depends on how you define democracy. If you define it the way we now do, is this Republican system of government, which is originally created to suppress democracy, well, they work quite well together. I think that it would not be possible to have a genuinely democratic society, that is, one in which people actually deliberated collectively and solved their decisions in a reasonable fashion through public assemblies and various other democratic forms, and you know, you'd have to go come up with more complicated things when you're on larger levels of administration. There's lots of ideas about what a really democratic society would be like. I don't think that would be possible with vast inequalities of wealth. I think that in a way, the founders were right when they said, if we have a system where a few people have all the wealth and other people don't, you can't open it up to everyone. You have to have a situation where people are not forced to pursue economic interests because of their desperate situation before people can sit around and think reasonably about what's best for everyone. But I think it's possible to achieve that. Mm-hmm.
You also said that there's good reason to believe that in a generation, capitalism will not exist. Again, one, how are we measuring a generation? And two, you know, what does it mean capitalism will not exist?
Well, I'm simply thinking of it this way. Capitalism, I mean, there's a million definitions of what it is, right? But they all seem to agree that it depends on growth, that if you don't have 5% national growth a year, you're not really pulling it off.
Well, wait a minute. There are lots of almost all of Europe.
I know.
And, it's, as we, and the United States.
We're in the doldrums. Everybody says that.
And there are few. And China is going from double digits down to 8 or maybe 7 even.
Precisely.
Depending on whose prophecy you believe. But
which is one reason why we have this financialization and debt crisis.
And Brazil, which all these emerging nations are finding some slippage in their annual growth as well.
Absolutely. This is the point that I'm making. For capitalism to be viable, it depends on this kind of growth. If that growth ends, and it has to, because frankly the planet can't actually sustain.
The other argument is simply that in fact quite the reverse is happening. What's happening is the rise of the middle class around the world is creating a bigger demand, and therefore capitalism will, quote, flourish.
Well, okay. The problem with that is resources. You don't actually have enough metal in the crust of the earth for everyone in China to have a car. So the standards that we've come to expect.
So you build plastic cars.
Well, that's a petroleum product.
Okay.
We're clearly hitting some kind of limits, and global warming is just the most obvious example of that. People are sounding greater and greater alarm bells every day about this sort of thing.
But then you make the argument. Can capitalism and environmental standards coexist?
Well, this is the interesting question. Capitalism, if it demands a certain level of growth, can it coexist? We all thought so. I'm going to be honest. People in the global justice movement imagined, when we sort of made up our plans, because we had to think, well, what's their plan so we can counteract it? We all thought green capitalism was going to be the big thing, that they were going to go from the current sort of debt-based neoliberal phase to this new green capitalism and declare an emergency and use it to appropriate even more resources to themselves. And we were kind of shocked that they didn't do it. And this is what I mean by people are incapable of thinking big. We can't come up with an effective response unless the other side comes up with their evil plan. And they don't really seem to be able to do so. There's this incredible lack of the ability to come up with visionary solutions, which world leaders used to have. Some of those visionary solutions were quite horrible, but at least they were capable of doing so.
Do you use the word anarchist to define yourself because you don't like any other word? I mean, you don't want to look at communism, you don't want to look at socialist, you don't want to look at fascist, you don't want to look at any other word that might describe a political philosophy, so therefore you settle on anarchy?
No, I settle on anarchy because I don't think anarchism is crazy. I think that very few people dislike the idea that everybody could cooperate and get rid of police and prisons and just all behave reasonably with one another. They
so
just think it's impossible.
Your definition of anarchism is more like libertarianism?
Well, the word libertarianism was actually coined by anarchists because people associated anarchists with bomb throwers, and then the right appropriated it. I think we also disagree with contemporary libertarians because they think that there will be capitalism and markets in a free society, and we feel that there won't. I mean, it's a matter of prophecy. They seem to think that, you can have this island where there's no state, but everybody who has property just sort of hires everybody who doesn't. And even if we can have an island over here where everybody has, sort of equal division of basic needs and carries on from there, we think that all the proletariat from their island will come to ours, and therefore it won't work.
I'm going to wind this up in the following way. I'm looking for a better way to ask this, but I don't have a better way.
Okay.
So what after capitalism, in your judgment, what exists and what do we call it?
Well, okay, here's the problem, I think. I'm not so worried that capitalism will survive. Everything comes to an end. This system shows all signs of not being able to fix itself.
But it wasn't so long ago when Francis Fukuyama was writing The End of History, because they thought exactly the opposite.
I know. Isn't it remarkable how quickly things change? So here we have the system we thought was going to last forever, self-destructing before our eyes. What I'm really worried about is the next thing they come up with might be even worse. It could be some sort of fascistic...
Who is they?
Well, whoever ends up picking up the pieces. I mean, there are models out there, the sort of populist, authoritarian, sort of China model is very popular in the third world right now. I think it's all the more important to develop actual democratic alternatives. I mean, so when people ask me what's my alternative to capitalism, I call it democracy. Why not have economic democracy? Have a system where people collectively make decisions that affect their own lives. How that's going to work out?
So you don't think we've ever made democracy work?
We've come close every now and then, but no. As I say, the system was not set up to be a democracy. I think democratic elements emerged. Politicians found is that ordinary Americans loved the idea of democracy, even though politicians at first hated it. So they kind of came around.
You and I both have friends, maybe not the same friends, who lived in communist countries, and they'd say, communism didn't fail. We never got it right.
Sure.
You're saying we've never gotten democracy right.
I think people were really even trying, to be honest, most of the time. I think there's nothing that terrifies the people running the political system in America more than the danger of democracy breaking out. If you look at the violent reaction they had to a bunch of camps and public parks, which weren't really hurting anybody, right? People were shot with plastic bullets, tear gassed, put in the hospital regularly. I mean, we still can't meet in public without being physically assaulted, despite the fact that we have this thing called the First Amendment, which appears to have been repealed now, saying that this is a fundamental democratic right. Why did they react in this panic fashion? I think the only explanation is they're terrified of real democracy breaking out.
Gillian Tett, who all of you who watch this program know, or most programs I do, because she is often a guest, says about this in the Financial Times, fresh, fascinating, Graeber's book is not just thought-provoking, but also exceedingly timely. His sweeping narrative history essentially argues that many of our existing ideas about money and credit are limited, if not wrong. That from Gillian Tett. I thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
That was an interview of anthropologist, author, and professor at the London School of Economics, David Graeber, talk show host Charlie Rose on PBS and Bloomberg, asked him about his 2011 book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. The publication at the end of 2021 of The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity, that David Graeber co-authored with David Wengrow, raised the interest in Graeber's prior work, and in early January, this long-lost interview reappeared on YouTube. Sadly, David Graeber is not present to enjoy the acclaim or to participate in debates about the many provocative ideas laid out in The Dawn of Everything. He died only weeks after finishing the book on September 2nd, 2020. He was 59 years young. This program is part of a celebration of the connection of David Graeber's work to the real-life events of our time. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.